The article is being read by Melissa Meyer. Here comes the band, Cultural Collaboration, Connective Traditions, and Aboriginal Brass Bands on British Columbia's North Coast, 1875 to 1964. BC Studies No. 152, Winter 2006-2007, a special theme issue entitled Past Emergent. Moment 1, Susan Nalen. In 2002, I visited Haida Gwaii, the Queen Charlotte Islands, for the first time. I was eager to see the new poles recently raised at Skidigit in the summer of 2001 and the Haida Run Museum at Kai Ilnenge. Along with a bit of natural history, the museum features, of course, Haida material culture. One room in particular is filled with historical pieces that most visitors associate with Haida artistic styles, poles, bentwood boxes, elaborately carved argillite. However, in the corner of this room, hanging on the wall, there are also two rather well-worn, obviously well-loved tubas and a big drum. Accompanying these is a photograph of the Skidigit Marching Brass Band. The caption reads, "The band had won three competitions on the mainland in 1910, 1911, and 1912. The cup, brought home with the band after that third win, is now located in the Skidigit Band Office. Nearly 100 years since being won in the Battle of the Aboriginal Brass Bands, the trophy is still held in high esteem by the village. She was only 5 years old, and she remembers standing in the hall on an Indian blanket, and that my grandfather was there in his band uniform. It makes you think of how the uniforms were used, and remember that, like traditional regalia, they were very valuable and indicative of one's prestige and high status. Because the potlatch ban also prohibited wearing traditional costumes and gave colonial authorities the power to seize such regalia, it was a way that the community members could appear in a type of regalia without risking going to jail. Several people we interviewed also mentioned that band uniforms were called regalia." Introduction. Numerous villages on the north coast of British Columbia along the Nass and Skeena Rivers, and by the earliest 20th century on Haida Gwaii, had at least one concert band, and some had several. A few had survived to this day, representing century-old traditions in their respective villages. Historically, these bands ranged considerably in form and function, from extracurricular school bands to full-blown uniformed marching bands representing an entire village, to Salvation Army bands, and, by the 1950s and 60s, to dance orchestras and jazz ensembles that played not only on land, but were also on cannery-operated ships and coastal fleets. Band members were skilled performers who regularly welcomed visiting dignitaries and competed for prizes. Performers spent considerable sums to purchase their brass instruments, while a few musicians even made their own. These collaborative ethno-historical study of the understudied phenomena of Aboriginal brass bands on the North Coast, especially among the Tsimshian, demonstrates how older cultural identities and practices persist in new forms, including those outwardly associated with assimilationist policies, mission life, and colonialism. The textual records on Aboriginal bands are scant yet provocative. Missionary publications, reports, and letters from the field, local newspaper articles, or the minute books kept by some of the bands themselves reveal how Aboriginal social, political, and cultural interests were served and advanced through musical performance. We learn that the bands played a full range of sacred and secular pieces and even some Aboriginal compositions at varied venues within the region and beyond. Local newspaper stories indicate the frequency with which contemporary observers recognized band members as gifted musicians and regularly called upon them to welcome visiting officials. In pursuing textual sources, however, photographs such as the one on the wall of the Cultural Center and the museum at Kai Ilnenge catches one's eye. Photographs of Aboriginal brass bands abound in archival collections and mission publications Some of them are formal band portraits. Others are more candid shots of the bands on the march, receiving visiting officials, or playing at weddings. This legacy added to the overall popularity and proliferation of Aboriginal brass bands before the Second World War. Struck by the compelling photos of the bands, historians have identified over 36 different groups in the province between 1864 and the first decades of the 20th century. Family members cherish images of their relatives in old albums or on display in their homes, framed memories that tie them directly to this musical past. Oral records reinforce the importance of such connections and provide a rich historical source, more complete than textual ones, on the scope of this musical movement among Aboriginal peoples. Over a dozen of these brass bands originated on the North Coast area among the Haida, Tsimshian, Nisga, Haisla, Hiltsuk, or inland among the Gixan. Bands came from the villages of Metlakatla, King Koleth, Port Simpson, the Nelson's Cornet Band, Masset, Skidigit, Greenville, Claxton, Ianch, Kitimat, Kitsamkalem, Kitkatla, Kitwanga, the Totem Pole Brass Band, and Canyon City. This article highlights a few of these brass bands and performance occasions, primarily examining how Aboriginal musical participation was viewed by natives in their villages and on the road, but also looking at what non-natives thought of it. The textual, pictorial, artifactual, and especially oral records reveal how Tsimshian social, political, and cultural needs were served through musical performance. Viewing brass bands within this historical and relational context, the authors find that these bands facilitated continuity with existing Aboriginal cultural traditions and modes of identification. At the community level, band membership and the types of local service provided by the bands highlight the complexity of maintaining and adapting cultural practices in light of the rapid change and repression brought about by the Aboriginal European encounter. These Aboriginal music groups acted in effect as a connective institution that intertwined family, community, and culture. Aboriginal brass bands were cultural collaborations. They were one of the ways in which Aboriginal culture adopted and adapted colonial forms to create new kinds of performative expressions. Such collaboration allowed them to work within and against the unequal power dynamic that characterized the native-newcomer relationship under colonialism. Outwardly, the bands appear simply to be capitulations to colonial endeavors, vivid symbols of civilized activities and replacements for old forms of entertainment. But in reality, they are much more complex cultural forms, proof of neither assimilation nor acculturation. For one thing, the bands permitted the engagement of age-old Tsimshian customs of public performance, travel, competition, and corporate identity within a modern context. For another, they facilitated new ways for chiefly village or tribal groups to demonstrate material wealth and to garner economic gain. Given what we now understand about the nature of First Nations resistance to colonialist practices, the bands can also be understood as one of the vehicles by which Aboriginal people stage performative protests against assimilationist programs, positioned the social group ahead of the individual, and publicly reasserted their rights to autonomy and self-government through repeated interactions with government and crown officials. Aboriginal resistance to colonialism has long been a major focus in the historiography of native newcomer encounters. Only recently have scholars begun to develop more sophisticated interpretations whereby definitions of such resistance involve acceptance as well as rejection, change as well as continuity, and adaptation to as well as appropriation of colonial cultures. Opportunities for performance were embraced by First Nations as forums within which to express precisely this kind of multifaceted response to the colonial process. As several historians have demonstrated for the case of Aboriginal participation in royal visits, while in public speaking tours at home and abroad, and during tercentenary celebrations in 19th and 20th century Canada, Aboriginal people were simultaneously integral to, yet separate from, public ceremonies, sometimes cast in their roles by the white elites that organized events, and sometimes thrusting themselves forward on the scene. As Paige Raibmon illustrates in her analysis of the Kwakwaka'wakw participation at the Chicago World Fair, their performances served more than one agenda, as the performers were motivated by the ability to earn money, to exercise cultural and social prerogatives, and to flaunt the assimilationist model being pushed by Canadian government officials. In comparable situations on British Columbia's North Coast, when the members of Aboriginal brass bands, although not always dressed up as the imagined Indian, played the parts of entertainer, ambassador, and role model before non-Aboriginal audiences, were they not also pursuing similar goals? In his wide-ranging discussion of the practice of modern ethnography among 20th century Indigenous peoples, James Clifford asks, what if identity is conceived not as a boundary to be maintained, but as a nexus of relations and transactions actively engaging a subject? Identities created and transmitted by musical performers were one such nexus. Self-representation balanced audience expectations for Indians on stage. Meaning and motive were negotiated and renegotiated through performance. As Veronica Strongbow and Carol Gerson argue for the case of Mohawk writer and performer E. Pauline Johnson, such interactions enabled Aboriginal people to talk back to the dominant culture. Without doubt, Tsimshian musical groups and those of their neighbors on the North Coast in the late 19th and 20th century spoke back to colonialism through concerts and band competitions. In any analysis of phenomena such as brass bands, the context of musical performance on British Columbia's North Coast must be a key consideration. In other words, we should reflect not only on who was playing and who was listening, but also why this was the case. A common refrain heard over the course of conducting our interviews was that we can better appreciate these musical groups when we interview them as institutions that connect family, community, and culture, a relational identity in the most literal sense, that of one's lineage. Thus, one level of band performances was not intended for the colonial audience at all. Our discussions with former and current band members and their families illuminated the continued relevance of bands as cultural institutions with long histories of serving their communities. Understanding the history of brass bands, therefore, captures a sense of Tsimshian identities between the 1870s and the 1960s, and perhaps more significantly, provides insight into the process of identification itself. Why brass bands? The roots of music. Interest in Aboriginal brass bands among academics remains underdeveloped, in contrast to the enthusiasm and interest they arouse in Aboriginal individuals when brought up in conversation. Scholarly investigations of Aboriginal music have been confined mainly to lyrical and notational analysis, and have almost universally ignored post-colonial forms like brass bands. Recently, this has begun to change. New studies pay attention to the performative contexts, for example, studies of musical forms as they occur in their specific reservation, reserve, and powwow environments, and studies that pay attention to the politics of music, focusing on dancing, singing, and playing as a means by which Aboriginal peoples negotiate and challenge lines of identity and citizenship. Our approach follows the latter trend. As Philip DeLoria reminds us, in his discussion of related phenomena in the United States, if music was intimately involved in the setting and selling of expectations of Indianness, Native American people were involved in recording, contesting, affirming, transforming, controlling, and performing those expectations in critical ways. Aboriginal brass bands were neither traditional Aboriginals dressed up so that missionaries and government officials missed who they really were, nor simply impose colonial forms created to replace existing performative traditions. Aboriginal cultures of the Northwest Coast cultural region have long valued music. Singing greeted the first European ships that showed up on the coast, and music has, since contact, played a major part in both secular entertainments and sacred rituals. Northwest Coast peoples traditionally engaged in performance and historically spent considerable portions of each year involved with private and public ceremonial activities. Feasting and potlatching occupied much of the winter season up and down the North Coast. Diverse manifestations of music, drama, and art played a huge role in the entertainments and ceremonies that accompanied these activities. To this day, chiefly displays of wealth or power, theatrical entertainments, and travel to other villages as representatives of kin, house, or village remain characteristics of most BC Aboriginal coastal groups. Indeed, one of the first attractions of Euro-Canadian-style musical groups, featuring expensive instruments, distinctive regalia, exclusive opportunities for material gain, like monetary prizes, trophies, and medals, and the exercise of political status, for example, when welcoming foreign dignitaries, must have been that they were the new spins on familiar practices. Tsimshian music came with powerful spiritual associations. Songs, for example, were often gifted from supernatural sources to signify the witnessing of spiritual transformations, or there were ways of gaining access to power or maintaining communication with non-human helpers. Several of the dancing societies originated among the Tsimshian's southern neighbors, suggesting a pre-existing tradition of receiving musical forms from external human donors rather than just supernatural ones. While music retained many of its sacred connections after the arrival of Europeans, the musical association of the European religions brought new opportunities. In this respect, Aboriginal brass bands on the North Coast have developed a strong and enduring historical connection to Protestant mission work. As the Vancouver province observed in the 1950s, First Nations chose their religion by the noise they made. Music was and is a key element in Christian rituals, and it is an attractive one for many Aboriginal converts. Music remains a major expression of Christian faith, whether as an integral part of early conversions and revivalistic activity, or as a form of regular worship among stable church congregations. It is not surprising that many missions had choirs and brass bands that played an active role in the Christianization process. Based on his experiences at the Tsimshian village of Metlakatla, the Anglican lay missionary William Duncan included the introduction of brass bands and other forms of music as part of his 20-part plan for successfully running a mission. Metlakatla's band was reputedly the first in the region, soon to be followed by others established in nearly every village with a missionary presence. Brass bands occasionally played in Christian services. Musicians who developed their abilities in these groups regularly assumed the role of choir leader or played the organ in community churches. Another direct link between Christian organizations and brass bands had to do with the fact that musical education was part of the curriculum at residential schools. This proved significant to the later appeal and dissemination of the bands. Musical instruction was long remembered by students as a haven in an inhospitable academic landscape, a landscape that otherwise robbed Aboriginal children of their freedom of expression and their identities. From playing in brass bands and cadet corps to Christmas pageants and children's choirs, exposure to music with bright tunes and improving sentiments had been intended to inculcate Aboriginal students into the Canadian way. Although both male and female students played in school bands, some of the female bands included New Metlakatla's Girls Zobo Band, Seashell's All Girl Fife and Drum Band, and the Kilted Girls Pipe Band from Williams Lake. Boys were especially encouraged to take up brass instruments. Music was a recreation, not simply recreation, and it was designed to impart regulation, order, and civilized behavior among students. Several of our interviews mentioned learning to play instruments or to read music while attending residential schools while attempts to instill rational leisure activities were part of the school's assimilationist agenda. On this point, musical education at Aboriginal residential schools in Canada had something in common with popular music trends within the British Empire and elsewhere. The 19th century brass band movement in Great Britain, according to historian Trevor Hebert, was characterized by the proliferation of bands, especially among the working classes, after the 1950s, and by their function of creating a common territory between the classes. He writes, "Many bands owe their origins to religious and moral movements, whose ideas found easy accord with those of the rational recreationist. Playing in a brass band was improving activity that supposedly kept its working class members away from public houses and other centers of corruption. The middle class movement to influence the moral leisure activities of the working classes was readily embraced by working people as their musical tradition. Missionaries acting with similar paternalistic intent introduced brass bands to Aboriginal people, and as with the English workers, their Aboriginal charges integrated brass bands into their own cultural traditions. In Australia and the US, as in Canada, musical education in native boarding and residential schools spawned adult brass band movements. In Mexico, by 1900, nearly every native village had at least one brass band as a central part of the community ceremonial life, which historian Guy Thompson insists cannot be seen as simply or even primarily a consequence of the pursuit of European tastes, musical standards, and urbanity. Pre-colonial musical forms endured through Mexico's brass bands, where they function as modernizing institutions. They still remained under native control and served the ceremonial and political needs of native villages. In light of these wider patterns, our example of brass bands on British Columbia's northwest coast does not appear to be unique. Brass band music was intended to inculcate civility and modernity among subordinated populations, be they defined according to class categories or racial categories. Yet Aboriginal players also reinvented those forms to serve their own cultural needs and religious expressions. For the Tsimshian, who had begun to add Christianity to their spiritual identities after the mid-19th century, one religious group that was particularly associated with brass bands was the Salvation Army. This Christian movement, which had been founded on the streets of industrial London and which used music to fight sin and poverty, arrived on British Columbia's northwest coast in the 1890s. Key characteristics of the Salvation Army, which did not always have a full range of band instruments, included the use of military uniforms, flags, drums, and lively music. First exposed to this appealing form of Christianity in Victoria in the late 1880s, the Tsimshian took it northward, where they operated their own versions of the Salvation Army for nearly a decade before the London-based army was shamed into opening an official mission amongst them. The musical tactics of the Salvation Army may have augmented the existing passion for music among First Nations of the coast. Indications of this appeared in local newspaper stories. According to a Prince Rupert newspaper account in 1911, for example, the Skidigit brass band started when a Haida saw a Salvation Army drum arrive, noted the firm that it had delivered it, and wrote for a catalog. Certainly a credible narrative given the history of the army in the region. Other denominations responded to the Salvation Army's success in converting Tsimshian people by introducing their own organizations, all of which prominently featured music, the Anglicans with the Church Army and the Methodists with the Band of Christian Workers and the Epworth League. Missionaries introduced Western musical forms to both children in day and residential schools and adults as part of daily life at a mission town. They encouraged music not only as a form of Christian worship, but also as an acceptable leisure activity. Indeed, missionaries hoped that, under their guidance, during the winter months, band music would be effective in keeping the men at home practicing and away from pursuits that hearkened back to pre-Christian times. First Nations, who had long had a passion for music, consider, for example, the importance of singing and dancing during the winter feasting season, likely viewed musical expression as both familiar and appealing. The playing of music had a seasonal rhythm and was similar to that of the traditional feasting season. Band members were among those who migrated each summer to the salmon canneries, where bands were used to signify the solidarity of Aboriginal workers. Tsimshian fishers were leaders in the union movement among BC Aboriginals, and accordingly, their brass bands often appeared at marches, rallies, parades, and during strikes. In the summer of 1900, workers in the fishing industry along the Fraser River went on strike. The Port Simpson Brass Band led the parade and played at the 15th of July rally in Vancouver. It also traveled to Nanaimo to raise funds for the striking fishers. There, the band's reputation as a symbol of working-class culture would have been very apparent to the local coal miners, who all had brass bands of their own. Closer to home, on the mid and north coasts, Aboriginal workers from Kitimat and Hartley Bay, who headed home from Low Inlet and Rivers Inlet after the close of the 1901 cannery season, were accompanied by the Kitkatla Brass Band, which played for each upon its arrival home and which gave concerts at the villages along the way. When interviewed, Chief Johnny Clifton confirmed that this cannery-related practice became an established tradition for the Hartley Bay Band, especially in 1904, later in the century. Regular practice resumed after the fishing season, and the entertainment that the bands provided brightened up the long rainy winters when people returned to their home villages. Port Essington's Tsimshian missionary Reverend William Henry Pierce declared in the early 20th century that, in midwinter, without the brass band, our village would seem dead. They really played very nicely, and their music is very much enjoyed by both whites and natives. In several villages, practice halls and bandstands were permanent fixtures, and people clearly took pride in being band members, even if they were involved in organizations such as fire companies, which had not been created with music in mind. Indeed, the Reverend George Henry Raley lamented that Kitimat's fire company had its own brass band even before it had pails, ladders, ropes, and axes. In this highly musical atmosphere, a number of impressive Aboriginal soloists and bandmasters emerged through non-Aboriginal outsiders, who were also commonly hired as instructors. Tsimshian Job Nelson was a remarkable musician and bandmaster who, from the late 19th century until his death in 1928, at age 70, performed multiple roles. He was at various times responsible for leading bands at Metlakatla, Port Simpson, Ianch, and New Metlakatla in Alaska. Besides being a teacher and a player, he also wrote music, notably the Imperial Native March, published in 1907 by Wiley Royce of Toronto. This piece was played at Ianch's brass band at the New Westminster Exhibition in 1905, where it was highly praised by the Royal Irish Guards Band. Job Nelson also composed pieces for particular villages. At the New Westminster Exhibition, the Ianch band also had performed a march entitled simply Ianch, that Nelson had written for the village during his tenure as its band instructor. Nelson also wrote at least two pieces for Hartley Bay, the Promise Island Waltz and the Antifreeze March. The Antifreeze March was designed to be played outdoors in cold weather because it required only limited use of the valves on the instruments. While Nelson's talents as a composer were exceptional, other Aboriginal composers also emerged to produce original pieces or to adapt compositions to full band formats. It is perhaps worth noting here that some individuals played many different instruments, even crafting their own. Speaking of her father, David Mason's extraordinary musical abilities, Kitsilla's resident Lorna Johnson reminisced about the many homemade instruments he used, ranging from handcrafted pieces made with combs, saws, chimney parts, and pot lids, to the flute-like harmonicas carved out of local wood. These instruments stood alongside others of more conventional use, such as the piano, the guitar, the ukulele, the banjo, the trumpet, and his favorite, the saxophone, that her father also played. home fashion instruments definitely harken back to older traditions of musical entertainments. Through Mason's embrace of foreign-produced objects was commonplace in the experience of many Aboriginal people. Reconciling a delight for musical performance with the adoption of new technologies denotes creative collaboration with and within colonial formats. The joy of musical performance in self-taught musicians prompted the sorts of spontaneous musical gatherings remembered by the daughter of missionary at Kispiox in Port Simpson. According to Margaret Booth, Nee Sanson, Sunday evenings in the early 20th century were for socializing. Typical of this tradition were the informal sing-song nights at the mission house accompanied by the brass instruments that Aboriginal people brought along. Then there is the experience of Reverend Robert Clyde Scott, who, working in the 1920s and 1930s aboard the United Church mission boat, the Thomas Crosby III, logged accounts of many impromptu musical evenings sparked when he brought out his guitar and was joined by local residents playing violins, mandolins, and other instruments. Residents of Hartley Bay also fondly recalled musically talented mission boat workers who relished the opportunities to jam with Aboriginal players. Growing up in Port Essington, Simshian Norman Brooks remembers with fondness the informal musical groups, a group of individuals gathered together to have a fun night, to break the monotony, and to simply have a social gathering. He went on to explain, "I think that it was really important for a small community to communicate in those days and have fun. It was real lots of fun." The more formal brass bands, however, were part of the colonial modifications and reformulation of pre-existing social functions such as potlatching, a Northwest Coast practice that was banned from the 1880s to 1951. Observing the effects of the revisions of and adaptations of potlatching among the Tsimshian during the period of its official ban, anthropologist Viola Garfield noted the emergence of new social groups whose membership was based on alignments that were neither family or nor clan-centered. At Port Simpson Loch Olam's, by the late 19th century, two fraternal orders, the firemen and the soldiers, not only had roles similar to those traditionally performed by lineages, but each group also had its own uniformed band. These bands, Garfield observes, were prominent in New Year's celebrations, funerals, and on other occasions when display was in order. A chief was their leader and bandmaster. Garfield explains that during her field work at Port Simpson in the 1930s, in addition to the musical groups of the fraternal orders, the Tsimshian community also had a town band, a dance orchestra, and a small choir. The Port Simpson Town Band is called upon to provide music for funerals, and members are paid by the relatives of the deceased, as though they belong to the paternal lineages of the deceased. Moreover, the band members have contributed funds to help pay for the funeral expenses of a few of their members. Playing at funerals remain a duty for existing bands today. We were reminded by several of our interviewees that Tsimshian bands were integral to all sorts of local ceremonies, including, for example, the opening of the light celebration, as Hartley Bay residents like to refer to the inauguration of their self-financed power plant in 1928. On this occasion, the Hartley Bay concert band was joined by the Haisla First Nation players from Kitimat, who come to help celebrate the event. A recent study by Ken Campbell finds that throughout the 20th century, Tsimshian bands and choirs traveled to other communities as part of a religious celebration called Diamelks. The above example suggests ways in which certain traditional Tsimshian functions were transposed onto brass bands in ways that were quite different from what had been intended by the missionaries when they first introduced them. Brass bands and other post-colonial musical forms, it seems clear, could serve to integrate people with, rather than distance them from, their cultural practices. While undoubtedly an example of musical entertainment, the involvement of brass bands in intertribal gatherings that coincided with wage labor opportunities notably the multi-tribal gatherings at canneries every summer, suggest that band music also became a feature of potlatches, a characteristic that harkens back to Melissa's story about her grandfather in his band uniform at a potlatch. In 1900, Methodist missionaries who accompanied their Kitimat congregations to the coastal salmon canneries observed that brass bands performed at a number of feasts attended by upwards of 500 natives from several different tribes. In 1945, Tsimshian ethnographer William Bainan observed that potlatching among the Gitxsan even featured musical instruments distributed as gifts, and that bugles, trumpets were used to call events to order. These examples of how brass bands were integrated into an older Aboriginal ceremonies points to a kind of cultural collaboration that stands quite apart from resistance to colonialism. Consider that band members were village representatives. In many cases, they were hereditary chiefs who, as clan and house representatives, reinforced the traditional ceremonial system by attending potlatch events that required their presence as both witnesses and participants. Hence, bands were valued because they were part of maintaining and adapting older cultural institutions that were crucial to the cultural and socio-economic survival of Northwest Coast First Nations. Welcoming brass, traveling afar, and winning royal affirmation. In his doctoral study of Aboriginal music, dance, and performance in the United States, John Troutman concludes that Native American musical troupes, jazz and marching bands, string quartets, and other outfits that traveled throughout the United States between the 1880s and the 1930s were, in effect, innovative modern expressions of Indian identity. Road-weary bands and Native celebrities, he argues, presented tribal, ethnic, racial, and musical identities that complicated and often contradicted the public's assumption of Indianness and the assimilative goals of the Office of Indian Affairs. Troutman's research demonstrates the frequency that with which Native American musical performances became occasions on which Aboriginal players confronted non-Aboriginal audiences about Indian stereotypes. With their boarding school educations, these seemingly assimilated Native musicians frequently appeared on a stage as testaments to the cultural survival of their peoples. They often wore traditional costumes and, in addition to playing instruments, gave lectures about their people's culture and history. Native performers also used such opportunities to publicly criticize American federal Indian policies, which involved termination and assimilation. This experience was not unique to the United States. In her analysis of Aboriginal visitors to Great Britain in the late 19th and 20th centuries, Cecilia Morgan concludes that while there was much that was formulaic and stereotyped about these displays, much that reinforced the British public notion of Aboriginal peoples played into imperial fantasies and desires, their performances were not homogeneous or completely formulaic. In British Columbia, Aboriginal brass bands traveled for ceremonial purposes. On these occasions, along with speeches, costumes worn by hereditary chiefs and other band members conveyed messages about their modern Aboriginal identity and cultural survival. The band uniforms may not have conformed to the non-Aboriginal image of traditional Indian costume, but they may have been taken as markers of assimilation, but their authority as one kind of Aboriginal regalia stemmed from the context within which they were worn. A good example of this is the frequency with which government commissions were greeted by brass bands, at which the assertion of Aboriginal rights formed a substantial portion of the oral exchange that followed the musical greetings. When the McKenna McBride Commission of 1913-16 visited the Northwest Coast, the Metlakatla, King Koleth, and Ianch bands played for the commissioners. At least one photographic record survives of the 1915 King Koleth delegation, comprised of Nishka chiefs and counselors dressed in Western attire, with one member still wearing his band uniform, awaiting its meeting with the members of the McKenna McBride Commission. The Port Simpson Concert Band traveled early and traveled far. It was the first Indian band to be heard in Seattle when it played at the Alaska-Yukon Pacific Exposition in 1909. Reportedly, Prince Rupert Town Boasters, the Prince Rupert Publicity Club, sent a contingent of approximately 300 city representatives to attend the fair's Prince Rupert Day. Among them was a Port Simpson brass band, which played at several venues in Seattle, including fair parades and dances. According to the Seattle Times, the Port Simpson Indian Band gave a concert yesterday afternoon that delighted the large crowd and whetted the public appetite for more of their music. Success was no stranger to this band, as it had won a number of similar accolades for its high-profile performances. In 1900, it won the Dominion Day Prize in Vancouver. In 1901, it entertained visiting royalty, the Duke and Duchess of Cornwall and York, the future King George V, and Queen Mary. And in 1905, it won a $600 purse in a competition involving 12 Aboriginal bands at the Dominion Exhibition in New West. The Port Simpson Band performed for Governor General Earl Grey in 1906, for Prime Minister Wilfrid Laurier in 1910, and for the Duke and Duchess of Connaught in Prince Rupert in 1912. This band was not unique. However, North Coast bands routinely played for visiting politicians, royalty, naval admirals, bishops, and the Department of Indian Affairs officials. In the heyday of the brass bands, from the 1880s to the interwar decades, Aboriginal communities made significant investments of time and financial resources to support community brass bands. While the belief that band uniforms were gifted by impressed audiences or mission supporters still circulates, many bands and their supporters paid considerable sums of their own money to purchase music and instruments and to outfit their players. In a property-conscious society, expenditures on these new technologies were also statements of wealth. Whether paid for by the players themselves through funds raised collectively by the whole community or by gifts from non-Aboriginal missionaries, the instruments and the uniforms were valuable property. Given that Aboriginal communities at this time were not fully within the cash economy, and that cash could be both scarce and difficult to accumulate at certain times of the year, the real cost to them was much greater than what is indicated by the dollar value of their expenditures. In 1880, King Coloth raised $600 to engage a bandmaster, the equivalent of more than a year's salary for the average laborer, skilled tradesperson, or domestic. The Reverend George Raley reported that the Port Simpson Boys' Home got its drum and fife band in 1907 from private subscriptions and the efforts of the students themselves, who made and sold Indian curios to raise the money. In 1912, the Metlakatla Band spent $1,600 to purchase brand new silver-plated instruments just in time for playing for the visiting Duke and Duchess of Connaught. Good-looking uniforms were a source of pride and represented substantial financial investment, as evidenced by the scandal that resulted when four Kitimat band uniforms were slashed while their owners played a game of baseball. The damage done to uniforms, which were reportedly worth $32 apiece, or the equivalent of 2 weeks' wages in 1916, was considerable. The local newspaper reported that the man who had been accused but acquitted of the crime had been motivated by jealousy. Uniforms were usually considered snappy military attire, sometimes literally, as was the case with Metlakatla's first band, which purchased old U.S. military uniforms, an ironic instance of cultural appropriation on the part of the colonized. On occasion, however, band uniforms were uniquely Aboriginal in style. In 1890, six Roman Catholic Aboriginal brass bands and choirs took part in the opening ceremonies for a new church in Sechelt. The Lillooet Brass Band wore buckskin suits, gaily decked with bright colored flowers. When the new Metlakatla Concert Band played Seattle's Grand Theater in 1904, it did so in native costume, cloaks, blankets, and hats painted with Tsimshian designs. According to one newspaper's account, The band members appeared quite the wild Indians in their barbaric splendor. When the Port Simpson Band participated in the Vancouver ceremonies to greet visiting royalty the Prime Minister Wilfrid Laurier in 1901, they were arrayed in the full glory of their war costume, bedecked with feathers and painted with enlivening hues. Instead of wearing their usual red and gold military-style uniforms, the band wore smocks with Northwest Coast designs painted by a celebrated Tsimshian Iroquois artist, Frederick Alexie. Each man had a liu, a cedar ring, around his neck, an adornment usually worn within traditional ceremonial contexts to signify the wearer was an initiate or a member of a secret society. Band members had a personal audiences with visiting dignitaries. Tsimshian chiefs presented the Duchess with the chief's headdress, Amholite, making her an honorary matriarch of the nation. It was all good fun, according to the Vancouver Daily World. One of the ladies of the royal party was taking a photograph of the Port Simpson Indians, and she laughed heartily when one of the Indian lads stepped forward and snapshotted her in return. But perhaps the man had turned the tables to make a point about being an object of photography, an irony overlooked by the newspaper reporter. Earlier, Chief Henry Nelson had worn the Amholite for the group's formal photograph in Vancouver, exercising his hereditary prerogatives and demonstrating his status. Many of the newspaper headlines remarked on the loyalty and enthusiasm displayed by Aboriginal band members. Reading between the lines, however, band members, hereditary chiefs among them, appeared to be acting as representatives of autonomous First Nations, and their private audiences with royalty and other dignitaries affirmed the continuing relationship of First Nations with the Crown. Over the years, the subject of the continuing relationship of the Tsimshian with the Crown has woven its way into a persistent community memory about band uniforms. A number of Tsimshian related to us a story about how they received their colors. Uniform colors were rigorously guarded, owned in a sense. They were seen by their uniform owners, such as Melissa's grandfather, Paul Price, as earned prerogatives to be proudly displayed at public opportunities that affirmed their ownership, as was the case with the traditional regalia of the past. Among musicians at Kitkatla and Port Simpson, claims that visiting royalty, including Queen Victoria, bestowed upon the bands their colors, ran through our interviews. Queen Victoria never visited British Columbia and had died before the alleged gift of the uniforms occurred, but such facts are irrelevant if we understand this story as a social memory. What counts is the meaning that such stories ascribe to the royal sanction of the brass bands. For Aboriginal people of British Columbia, most of whom never had the opportunity to sign treaties with the Crown, their historical connection to the Crown as autonomous self-governing nations remains, to this day, a significant one. The fact that several governors, including the Crown's representative in Canada, and the children and grandchildren of Queen Victoria heard the bands play and on state occasions delivered gifts to Aboriginal communities in the presence of the bands, affirms a kind of royal sanction of the musical groups. The exchange of symbols of authority, like the chief's frontlet from Chief Nelson to a future Queen of England in 1901, or the gift of an autographed photo of King George V to the Kitkatla band later in the century, should not be underestimated. This crown recognition had deep political importance at a time when BC coastal First Nations were struggling under colonialism to assert their rights to land and resources. The brass bands were part of a performative context that allowed First Nations to assert their position. In other words, it was their music, not merely the chief's welcomes and speeches, that talked back to colonial officials. That Aboriginal communities had a deep vested interest in bands is evident in how they viewed band property. Port Simpson band uniforms and instruments were communally owned. As Sharon Bryan explains, the uniforms belonged to the band. It was the community that did the fundraising for the band, and so they weren't taken as personal possessions. It was passed down, and you'll see old names in the uniforms that these younger generation are wearing now. So it just gets passed. It gets returned after members die or they retire. This corporate ownership of band property sets some Aboriginal bands apart from their non-Aboriginal counterparts in the region. The Port Simpson's band's rigorous record keeping, which persists to this day, demonstrates a sense of accountability to the community. It also reveals the significant contributions women made towards the success of the band. Without the fundraising expertise of Tsimshian women, there would have been no travel to competitions, no state visits, no money to purchase music, uniforms, or instruments. Along the Nass River, the Greenville Concert Band, which typically fronted between 50 and 60 players in the 1950s, surely most of the adult male population of the Snishka village, was deemed a community institution. Financially supported by the village, the band, as Johnson Russ told anthropologist Philip Drucker in the mid-20th century, belonged to the village. The concert arrangements and travel had to be approved by the village committee. Russ added that of all the social organizations in contemporary Greenville, the band counts as the most important society. In many North Coast village groups, male hereditary chiefs acting as band leaders extended their traditional leadership roles and maintained old social structures within these outwardly new cultural forms. The notion of communal property, the presence of consecutive generations of players, and the hereditary nature of positions within the band all point to distinctly Aboriginal characteristics. Trophy cups, medals, and badges express the same kind of pride and political value as did band uniforms and instruments. The accomplishments and recognition of competitive performance were cherished, as the opening vignette about the Skidigit Haida's cup illustrates. An even more dramatic illustration is provided by the Tsimshian village of Greenville. In 1933, when fire destroyed the Greenville Concert Band's trophies, the organizers immediately replaced, at great cost, the cups won at the annual Prince Rupert competitions in 1914, 1920, and 1921. The commemorative badges and medals awarded to the individual band members have always been held in high esteem by their owners. Skidigit cornet player Arthur Moody received a gold watch and medal from the Governor General of Canada in recognition of his musical and conducting abilities. When attending the Prince Rupert Sea Fest celebration in the mid-1980s, Port Simpson band member Charlie Henry wore both the medal that his father James Henry had been awarded while performing in the band in 1912 and a medal celebrating the 50th anniversary of his own membership from 1934 to 1984. Such ongoing connections to local brass bands links past and present players in a cultural continuum. Competition was a long part of Tsimshian musical traditions, as it was among many of their Aboriginal neighbors. Song battles regulated by formal rules and feasting protocols frequently took place between rivals. These were held in public settings to allow for full witnessing of the contest's outcomes. In the 19th and early 20th centuries, most competitions appear to have been provided performative ways to continue old rivalries, usually between villages, and they undoubtedly serve to reinforce individual status. Beginning in the 1910, competitions between Aboriginal brass bands were a regular and colorful feature at Prince Rupert's Victoria Day, known at the time as Empire Day and Dominion Day celebrations, and from 1913 to the mid-1940s at the annual Northern Agricultural Fair. Local newspapers' report of competitions often included vivid descriptions of which bands came, what they did, what they looked like, and what music they played. In the 1911 Empire Day competition, much of it held on the Prince Rupert Wharf, seven Aboriginal bands competed with Skidigit, who took top prize for the second year in a row. Interestingly enough, the next year, the Haida showed up to play only to discover that the Empire Day competition had been cancelled. Accordingly, they claimed the cup by default, agreeing to play a challenge much later in the year when the Governor General was due to visit. overcoming the original slight, winning the trophy for the third time, and thus earning the right to a permanent claim on it, the Skidigit Haida still display this piece in their band office. The band competitions also cemented relations between the largest town in the northern region, Prince Rupert, and the area's Aboriginal people. In city papers such as the Daily News and the Evening Empire, reporters frequently remarked upon the unexpectedly good and musically ambitious nature of the band's efforts. Sometimes they resorted to the inversion of popular stereotypes of the savage Indian to make their point. The terror of the coast, who, in bygone years, had arrived in war canoes, lusting for blood, now arrived in smartly dressed uniforms, bedecked with gold braid, armed not with club and scalping knife, but with musical instruments. Most articles, however, conveyed a sense of genuine regard for the musical talents of visiting Aboriginal bands, a blurring of identities that other scholars have reported as being characteristic of Aboriginal performances. Beyond a doubt, the musical ability of BC Coast Indians native to the districts of Prince Rupert is one of the most interesting and admirable surprises of the whole district for the newcomer. The Aboriginal groups are proficient musicians with proved qualities as good sports, willing to contest musical events together and to win or lose band trophies with the utmost self-control, whether in victory or disappointment, and they are exceedingly willing to entertain. As well, the non-Aboriginal townspeople viewed Aboriginal bands as loyal representatives of their communities and families. They came among us well-dressed, well-behaved, full of loyalty, and showing every evidence of quick adaptation to civilized methods, quipped the Prince Rupert Evening Empire. Both Aboriginals and non-Aboriginals framed the band's presence as demonstrating loyalty, for example, by attending the Empire Day or Dominion Day and by participating in annual fairs. The Ianch counselors who accompanied the Nass Indian Band to celebrate Empire Day in 1911 were quoted as saying, "We don't spend our time and money in Prince Rupert to compete for a prize, but to show our loyalty to king and country." Northwest Coast peoples continued to assert themselves as sovereign peoples at public events, ironically honoring the British Crown and Canadian nation, even as these powers denied them such status. Out of the church, onto the street, and into the dance hall, the legacies. Musical forms certainly wound their way out of the church and into the dance hall. Through the interwar period, into the post-war decades of 1950s and 1960s, dance orchestras proliferated into the villages, for some continuing the tradition of playing music long after the marching bands had disappeared. Travel remained an important part of the life of these smaller groups. From native music ensembles such as Stewart's Orchestra of Kincolith or the seven-piece dance orchestra under Port Essington's Louis Starr, who often played for Prince Rupert dances in the 1930s, to post-war groups such as the Super Dupers, Hartley Bay, Chester's Bolton's Band, Kit Catla, or Morris Morrison's Orchestra, Port Simpson, and the Hartley Bay Five. Popular music was definitely part of Aboriginal musicians' repertoires. The Hartley Bay Five was, in its day, the best-known band on the North Coast, in part because from 1954 to 1964, it played every New Year's Eve at Prince Rupert's Bluebird Ball. Band members Fred Bolton, Reggie Mason, Johnny Clifton, and Steve and Charlie Robinson performed jazz tunes for dances at Hartley Bay and at other coastal communities, Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal alike, located as far away as Vancouver Island. They practiced where they could, and this was especially difficult during the busy fishing season. Johnny Clifton remarked how they often got gigs after being heard in rather unlikely places. Once they were hired to play at a wedding after they had been heard practicing on a fishing boat. A player of country, rhythm, and bebop in the 1960s, Norman Brooks recalls that when he worked at Cassiar Cannery in 1958, dance bands flourished as weekend entertainment across the North Coast region. People used to come in to Cassiar by train loads from as far as the Hazelton area bring their instruments with them. They'd be practicing, ready to go, you know, on weekends. Used to be just crowds of people outside listening to the rock and roll bands, getting warmed up for the season to go play for dances and stuff. He remembers that those just-for-fun jam sessions brought families and community together. The connection between playing in a band and kinship ties was an especially strong theme for those families with multi-generational legacies as performers in the brass bands. As longtime Port Simpson concert band player Harvey Russell Sr. summed it up for us, "It's mainly all like a family band." His wife, Gloria Russell, elaborated, speaking about the difficulties they experience in maintaining the band tradition in the face of 21st century life. "Right now, our younger people, band players, have moved away for work, and it's not easy to get them together. But they do make an effort to get here for special occasions. Some just come in for a few hours and they're gone, and they have jobs and they have families. And yet the Prince Rupert Band managed to hold a 25-year reunion for band members in Prince Rupert in 2003, and several of the present members have expressed the hope of winning the opportunity to play at the 2010 Olympics to be held in Vancouver, demonstrating that many of the forms and functions of the century-old institution continue. And the bands play on. Today, the long history of brass bands on British Columbia's north coast is not widely known or understood. While communities such as Skidigit publicly display battered tubas and drums in their museums, others keep their band instruments out of sight. Indeed, all communities with a history of bands seem to have kept some of the old instruments, trophies, and uniforms. But in the current climate, which emphasizes the advance of Aboriginal rights in legal and political forums, brass bands may not be the vehicle through which they want or need to express their traditions. Several people told us that the younger generation prefers dance and drum troops as signifiers of their Aboriginality, and rightly so. But for many, the historical connection to brass bands as a form of cultural collaboration remains strong, especially as part of their family history. The resonance of this fascinating musical history may be seen as a declaration as public as that of the Port Simpson Band marching down the streets of Prince Rupert during Sea Fest, or in an emotional connection as intimate as that felt for a single instrument by the daughter of its owner. While discussing Aboriginal bands, Simshian Lorna Johnson showed us her most prized possession, the violin her deceased father had fashioned himself. "Every now and then I take it out and look at it," she told us. "I don't play instruments, but when I get lonesome for him, I always take it out." Aboriginal cultural traditions under colonialism always reflect a lived history, including the vast array of creative responses to change brought about through the arrival and presence of Euro-Canadians. It is important to look at the cultural continuities that make Northwest Coast Aboriginals the people they are. We should also identify emergent cultural forms like Aboriginal brass bands in order to recognize the enduring vibrancy of these adaptive cultures under and even in spite of colonialism. By considering Aboriginal brass bands' activities as real cultural performances, their meanings become more than simply expressions of public Aboriginal identities. Brass bands tell us about the modes of Aboriginal identification within a colonial world. Scholars should resist the temptation to essentialize cultural boundaries according to colonial binaries: traditional, modern, colonized, colonizer, authentic, inauthentic, civilized, uncivilized, dichotomies that inevitably paint post-contact Aboriginal culture as diminished and inauthentic. Indeed, Aboriginal performances, whether playing Indians or playing instruments, may be one realm in which the complexities of colonialism are most apparent. Relational identities, different messages offered to different audiences, and multiple levels of meanings for players and listeners alike all serve to problematize culture change in a productive way. They illustrate how Aboriginal peoples collaborated as they resisted, changed cultural forms as they preserve their cherished traditions, and transform new ways by navigating them according to the old. Our ethno-historical research into Northwest Coast Aboriginal brass bands in the 19th and 20th centuries demonstrates how older cultural identities and practices persist in new forms, including those outwardly associated with assimilationist policies, mission life, and colonialism. At the community level, brass band membership and the service the bands perform locally at weddings, funerals, and dances reveal that these institutions were traditional, yet adapted forms. Bands enabled First Nations to represent themselves either as loyal allies of the British Crown or as working class members of a union movement. Travel, public performance, music, and special regalia have long characterized Northwest Coast people's rituals and social lives. Since the late 19th century, the adoption of brass instruments and fancy band uniforms originating in Christian missions has represented new kinds of property and wealth. Furthermore, the bands were a venue within which to compete with old rivals, to reassert sovereignty before representatives of the British Crown, or to just have fun. The bands facilitated the exercise of chiefly prerogatives and corporate identity and bound community and family together. Although really a musical form of another era, a few of these brass bands or versions thereof remain today. Indeed, several individuals expressed the hope that, with the installation of music programs in village schools, community musicians would again emerge to take up the tradition so that the bands might play on.